Ted Olson is here behind me, and we will start as soon as we sit back down and grow attentive again and start taking notes and put away our laptops and iPhones. Stop all this desultory conversation. The techie people are off to their digital world. Godspeed and God bless. We're going back to the 1920s where we belong. Nothing like nostalgia for something you never experienced in the first place. I just learned that Ted Olson had nothing to do with George W. Bush's Justice Department. That was another... Am I right?
You are right.
All right. I don't know. Is it much of a burden going around with a name like or does anybody really know who that is?
It has been at times, yes.
He was sort of back again in the in the gay rights movement recently, and that was interesting too, because he didn't come down on the side that everybody expected him to. I just met Ted 30 seconds ago for the very first time, but I have followed his work with exceptional interest. He is on the faculty at East Tennessee State University. Yeah, you hear Steve Ramey says, "Shut up," and. There's still an exodus. What is it? Nobody wants to know about hillbilly music in Johnson City. What's wrong with you guys? This is, I guess we're too far from Johnson City. Anyway, Ted is the guy who masterminded two of these monstrously wonderful, wonderful Bear Family collections. I'm sorry Richard Weitz has been here and gone. I know he would like to be here to enjoy this one too. The first one being about the records that were made in Bristol, Tennessee in July and August of 1927 that did a lot of, I don't like this word, iconic. It is really overused, but these very significant recordings that included the Stonemans and Carters and Jimmy Rogers. And that went well enough that Ted and Richard and Tony Russell collaborated to do another set of music, much less well-known, but equally interesting musically, of records that Columbia made in Johnson City, Tennessee, a little ways to the west of us here, in 1928 and again 1929. Once again, the packaging that comes with the music is beautiful. There's incredible amounts of documentation, pictures, and everything that you've never seen. So Ted Olson is someone I've admired from afar for a while. I'm very glad to meet him and grateful for the opportunity to introduce him to you. Ted?
Thank you so much for being here. And it's a true honor to be in the company of you, and you've inspired me for many, many years. Forgive me if at times my presentation seems like a personal pilgrimage to music, but I guess that's one way to share with you the story of my interest in Appalachian music, because I'm not from Appalachia, so I think it's important to have a sense of perspective about where I'm coming from in relation to the music that I love and that I'm trying to share with the world in various ways. Let the music be heard is, you know, sounds almost like a cliche or something, but in fact, you know, so much of the world's great music is not widely heard, and that was quite clear to me growing up in Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up. I know a lot of you know that music community, and it's a very rich one. I was in some ways very honored and lucky to grow up there in some very real ways that I'll try to address here. Although I can honestly say I'm very happy to live now at 4,700 feet in elevation in the southern Appalachians, surrounded by a culture that, while misunderstood, is certainly extremely rich and ever-changing, although perhaps the world isn't fully aware of that culture and how it is changing. And what it is comprised of. Well, in terms of a personal trajectory or history, I'm going to just quickly share with you the LP, we talked about LPs before, that kind of changed my world at age 6, the Folk Box from Elektra Records. Kind of a, for years, a forgotten or overlooked popular anthology of American folk music. It's not the Harry Smith anthology of American folk music. It doesn't have that kind of reputation, perhaps. But nonetheless, it's an important anthology for a variety of reasons. For me personally, it was my introduction growing up in D.C. to American folk music at age 6. Talk about personal family record collections. I don't think my parents had 1,000 records. They had 200. Most of them jazz and classical, but this was the one kind of more popular, more accessible record for a young person. And I delved into it and listened to it and probably wore it out because, as it turned out, my mother had eventually given it away because it was no longer playable. So from 1966 on forward, which is when I discovered this set, which was released in 64, the records on this set that truly moved me were records by, as it turned out, people from Appalachia. I had no concept of the mountains until later. But fabulous recordings by Clarence Ashley or Doc Watson and, you know, so the handful of Gene Ritchie, the handful of acts that were on the folk box who were from the Appalachian Mountains had a special kind of intrigue for me at the time. And unbeknownst to me at the time, of course, set me off on a lifelong kind of journey to find out more about those people, their music, and their culture. So a word about Appalachia. A map from the Appalachian Regional Commission designates the government's official delineation of Appalachia and divides it into sub-districts. It's a problematical map by any definition. If you'll notice, for example, western Virginia, northwestern Virginia, the Blue Ridge, in many ways, the heart of Appalachian heritage in the Shenandoah Valley and the Blue Ridge Mountains there are, in fact, not included in the government's description of Appalachia. So it is a political definition of Appalachia that I'm sharing with you now. But it's also the only official map of Appalachia that all people tend to, if not agree with, then at least acknowledge. You'd be hard-pressed to find another agreed-upon map of Appalachia anywhere. There were some earlier versions by John C. Campbell, an Appalachian scholar in the early 20th century that are influential to scholars, but not necessarily beyond that small school of true kind of historically-based scholars wanting to know the ways in which the reputation and the definition of Appalachia might have changed over the years. So this, I would say in part, is the boundary that we tend to confront in the field of Appalachian studies. You'll see it goes into southwestern New York, much of western, in fact, much of central and even eastern Pennsylvania, and encompasses northeastern Mississippi, the northern half of Alabama. I won't belabor the point, but this is all on the government webpage, arc.gov. So as I talk about Appalachia in this presentation, this is the backdrop and the controversy, and in fact, the definition that I struggle against as much as work with. Okay. I personally now live in this area here, just outside of Johnson City, Tennessee, on the North Carolina-Tennessee border. And I moved to Appalachia, though, in 1979 as a teenager into, this section of West Virginia, Hampshire County, the oldest county in West Virginia. And it's very much an extension of the Shenandoah River Valley, but it is included in the ARC boundary. By 1979, when I moved to Appalachia, I had already had a kind of an ongoing interest in Appalachia, as I'll sketch for you here, and of course the music of Appalachia. We all know this famous record, and all due credit to Arthur Smith, who, you know, just recently passed away, but this was his great tune that was co-opted by Warner Music for the soundtrack And Arthur Smith had the last laugh through a lawsuit where he approved authorial rights to the Dueling Banjos composition. But this was, of course, for a young person in an urban area outside Appalachia. Many of my peers, for example, this was our first exposure to images of Appalachia, based on, of course, the novel, which is really a fine novel by James Dickey. The film version is also, many people claim, a fine action picture and such. And yet, of course, stereotypes were portrayed through the film. Stereotypes of Appalachia are an ongoing obstacle and theme in the study of Appalachian culture, and we'll kind of move forward with that as one of our sub-themes here. All I can say personally to this soundtrack is that this soundtrack inspired me to purchase my first banjo, as I think it did a lot of my peers at the time. Beyond that, there's so much we could say. We could spend an hour debunking some of the stereotypical representations in the film. But the film is a creation of its era and a powerful one at that. Well, the music itself is still being heard, and Dueling Banjos was a major American hit on the AM radio. So it did influence a lot of people and fixed in their minds certain images, very stereotypical images of Appalachian culture, as we know. This was, in many respects, after the Folk Box, the record that launched me and fully committed me to the understanding Appalachian culture and the powers of Appalachian music. Gene Ritchie's amazing two-volume collection for Folkways, recorded for Kenneth Goldstein, early 60s. I stumbled upon this in the local library in Washington, D.C., and had a strong interest in every word that she sang and every nuance. The silences between the lyrics is what kind of made me realize that music is a lot more than, something that is easily comprehended by a child's mind. I did not understand the power of these ancient stories sung by Gene Ritchie, but I wanted to. And so I set off to listen to it from all kinds of angles, including, in 1979, taking a cassette version of this album with me to a summer camp in West Virginia. I pointed out where that was located, my first entree into Appalachia. And I took this recording of this particular album into the woods on a portable cassette player and played it. I don't know why I did, but it felt like the right place to listen to Gene Ritchie singing these unaccompanied child ballads. Lo and behold, a whole kind of herd of deer gravitated to me. I later told Gene Ritchie this, and she was just very moved by this. Didn't think it was weird one bit. Thought it was a nice compliment that the deer liked her music. So these Folkways records, as many of you, made a huge difference in my life. The quality of the packaging, I mean, we could debate the technical aspects a little bit, I suppose. But we're not here to do that. We're here to celebrate the legacy of Folkways. The taste that Mo Ash had, the openness to the kinds of musics that he released, phenomenal. As well as the interpretive aspects, the insert liner notes were certainly to be commended, as were the liner notes that Kenneth Goldstein included in this album, as with many other Folkways albums, made a huge impact on me as a young person, as I'm sure many of you likewise were influenced. Well, anyone growing up in the 70s dealt with albums such as this one. You know, popular albums, very best-selling albums that, shall we say, brought aspects of the Appalachian music story to a popular audience with, in my contemporary perspective or present-day perspective, not fully doing justice to the music that they celebrated in a set like this. Not to take anything away from the power of musicianship on this wonderful anthology or collection, artifact of its era when the hippie musicians met the old-time country crowd and made incredible music together. So this was influential on me, as on many people. But I pretty quickly distanced myself from this kind of album by my mid-teen years. Not that I didn't love the music on there, but there was no context provided in this kind of record. Chet Flippo wrote some very impressionistic notes that were very well done and powerful as kind of a general statement about the power of this coming together of two cultures, two generations of musicians. But I wanted to know more about the artists themselves. I wanted to know where they came from, what the music meant to them, why this type of record should last, why it should be forever archived in our collective consciousness, other than by the virtuosic music performances captured on the set. And in a sense, this record didn't do it for me, ultimately. Now, a lot of independent labels were getting closer in the 70s to, shall we say, embracing a true picture of Appalachian music and musicians. This is one that particularly caught my attention. Don Stover, of course, Things in Life. While it was released as a commercial release, as opposed to perhaps a set of field recordings, it had a spirit of capturing a man in his culture and in his place that I think was implied more than stated, but nonetheless should be applauded. Rounder clearly wanted to bring this man's West Virginia roots as a central theme in the album package. Now, it didn't hurt that he was a master banjo player and an amazing songsmith or a tunesmith, an excellent release all the way around. So, you know, as we move forward, some companies were doing things right to the extent that they felt the market would sustain. And I just wanted a tip of the hat to this release. The next release, I believe it was the next one, maybe it was the previous one, On Rounder of Don Stover, liner notes were written by a later colleague and friend of mine, whose name will appear again in this talk, Jack Toddle. So here I was, far from Appalachia when this came out, and I became a huge fan of it. But it definitely started to mark my future. Growing up in Washington, D.C., my mother, for example, worked for the Association for Community Colleges in downtown Washington on DuPont Circle. Three blocks away was the Appalachian Regional Commission headquarters. And so a good friend of mine in junior high school's father was a lawyer for the ARC in Washington. So I became conscious of some of the political and socioeconomic issues of Appalachia at a very, very young age. And so I started to read, probably unduly for my own good, about the history of Appalachia. And it was certainly a turbulent history. The controversial book, but also a powerful book by Harry Caudle, Night Comes to the Cumberlands, was in fact the book that inspired the creation of the ARC. So this was a book I started with and read many other books through the 1970s on to the present day. If any of you have not read this book, this is certainly a book that will explain a lot about the eventual kind of misrepresentation across American culture of Appalachian people. But, you know, we must also say that Caudle contributed a few additional misunderstandings about Appalachian culture through his own take of the Appalachian story, although he was, of course, an Appalachian defender living in the heart of Appalachia, taking on the coal companies in defense of the coal miners in the 60s and 70s. So a hero, but of course this was the book that launched in many respects not only the ARC, the Appalachian Regional Commission, but the Appalachian Studies movement. And I teach within that field today at East Tennessee State University. There were also, of course, a lot of popular books that affected the national consciousness of what was Appalachia, what is Appalachia. And I want to say that while the Foxfire book series, best-selling books by any definition, Grove Books printed the total sales of this book, and it numbered over, I believe, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of copies, since the early 70s. And of course, there are more than a dozen in the series by now. Some of them are more focused on, shall we say, cultural context. Others are impressionistic sketches by high school students. It's a very important educational project. Probably a lot of you are aware that the Foxfire book started in Northeast Georgia by a school teacher who was having trouble teaching his children of Appalachian background to take an interest in, say, Shakespeare and Dickens and these traditional kind of internationalist approaches towards teaching literature. And so he realized he could teach students of that area to appreciate reading and learning by having them go out and interviewing their relatives, their friends and families in Northeast Georgia and Southwest North Carolina. And high school students then wrote magazine sketches, and they were ultimately published first in a magazine, the Foxfire magazine, and then in this series of books. Many music topics, of course, were also featured, including a banjo maker named Jerry King, who became a good friend of mine later, was profiled in one of these books. So influential series of books, but controversial again, because of, and I would argue in the case of the Foxfire series, a romanticized portrayal of Appalachian people that was just as entrenched and just as dangerous as the more critical or more antagonistic stereotypes found in many other portrayals, such as Deliverance, the film. Later on, I wrote my own book, and hopefully I did not contribute excessively to the stereotyping of Appalachia. I certainly endeavored not to. This is a book that encompassed maybe 20 years of my own thinking about Appalachian culture from the late 70s into the 90s. It came out in 98. I was a National Park Service ranger on the Blue Ridge Parkway when I wrote this. This was a shot basically out my back door where I was stationed in Water Rock Knob, North Carolina. What to say about this is that while it was a holistic view of Appalachian culture focusing in on the Blue Ridge region, I did find that the hardest sections to write were the sections on music. Why? I felt so close to the topic, and yet I still hadn't cracked the nut of totally comprehending the essence of Appalachian music, I believe, at the time. Therefore, I was too close, and it was painstaking to write about Appalachian music. But I was trying to write about Appalachian music for this book in a way that championed the music without sentimentalizing the music, that was conscious of the stereotypes without contributing to them, aware that Appalachian music had often been represented by way of turning certain Appalachian musicians into icons without necessarily comprehending the infrastructural stories that related to the culture that maybe transcended individual talents. I tried to walk that line in with this book. I don't know if I got there, but I certainly tried. Moving right along, in 1998, just as that other book came out, I was invited to edit the music section for the Encyclopedia of Appalachia. It was an 8-year process of compiling the book itself. And I worked with 75 different scholars to create the music section. It ended up being something like 180 different entries that went into the Encyclopedia of Appalachia. I know a few folks in the group here today, among the audience, among you folks, helped me with that process. It ended up being the largest section in the Encyclopedia of Appalachia. It could have been a book published separately and it would have been a sizable book. And of course, I was most appreciative to all those people I networked with to create this music section. 8 years later, after the section was complete, the University of Tennessee Press put this music section, only the music section from the Encyclopedia of Appalachia book, this came out in 2006, by the way, but I kind of wrapped up work on that in 2004, and in 2012, an online Encyclopedia of Appalachian Music section was posted with free access. You can go back to your hotels or whatnot and access it at some point, but be that as it may, this was put online in 2012 with the express purpose of bringing this knowledge more accessibly to a new generation. The book itself, I don't know if it's sold to the extent that the University of Tennessee Press hoped. I do know that when it was published, it was 8.5 pounds, and they issued a birth announcement. So, and I kid you not, that was their promotional angle for it. But now it's the music section's online, updated, and expanded. So I realized in the process, not only did I meet wonderful people who were likewise passionate about Appalachian music, that was a major kind of outcome for me personally, and we also got what I hope was a comprehensive view of Appalachian music out to the world. Beyond that, I think it kind of toughened my own view of Appalachian music and led me to the next step. Part of that next step was meeting Charles Wolfe, maybe a friend of many of you folks here today. Of course, sadly, he passed away in 2006, but right before he passed away, this book came out in 2005 with McFarlane, who have a table here at ARSC. This was the outgrowth of our brief friendship. I mean, I met him in 2000, and in 2005, this came out. Of course, Charles deserves all the credit for bringing the story of the Bristol Sessions. Well, most of the credit. The other person we should credit, of course, Tony Russell. They kind of brought this story forward. But Charles, I think most among everybody, articulated the story of the Bristol Sessions and championed it when nobody else really realized how important that one particular location recording session was. And if I'm leaving anybody out who's in the room here, I'd love to know more about the story that you have about the Bristol Sessions and its kind of rediscovery. Well, be that as it may, Charles had written a terrific essay, The Legend That Peer Made. And this essay was looking for a larger kind of framework, and I offered to work with him to provide that framework, and this book was that, we hope. Of course, we hope to expand it too now, because many new insights have been gained about the Bristol Sessions and other Appalachian-based location recording sessions. So we hope to put out a new edition of this, as well as perhaps an expanded or a complementary volume in the near future. I also, in 2003, worked with the Smithsonian on the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. This was off their webpage, but I was the co-curator of the Appalachia Heritage and Harmony program celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Bristol Sessions. So the Smithsonian Folklife Festival decided to work with the Birthplace of Country Music Alliance and East Tennessee State University in compiling this exhibit on the Mall in Washington in 2003. Having grown up in D.C., it was kind of bringing it all back home in a sense. Over 1 million people visited the exhibit. Possibly some of you were there enjoying the music that was demonstrated on the Mall. We had exhibits and performances and interpretive materials that I helping with Jeff Place and a number of other scholars on that particular project. I do want to say that serendipity led to an enhanced kind of portrayal of Appalachia in a global context, because the other two exhibits that year in 2003, you know, the Smithsonian Folklife Festival usually brings three or four exhibits together at the same time. The other two were Scotland and Mali. And with Mali, we were able to kind of draw connections between the African roots of Appalachian music and culture, and with Scotland, of course, the Scots-Irish or Celtic connections. There were a lot of cross-fertilizing performances, both on stage and in the hotel rooms during the exhibit. So it was an interesting time and an interesting experience. It also brought to bear, for me personally, and I think for other scholars at the time, is that the American public still retains highly stereotypical views of Appalachia. In fact, one of the most interesting outcomes of this whole exhibit was a paper that was written by Emily Satterwhite, a scholar, in which she surveyed visitors from all over the world to this exhibit and asked them questions of their perceptions of Appalachia. And this article is published in the Appalachian Journal. And it was quite astounding to me the kind of Neolithic perspectives that many people had of Appalachia, who with open hearts were embracing the music and loving the exhibit, but fostering these really damaging stereotypical views of Appalachian culture and being quite open about it because they didn't realize that what they were thinking was perhaps incorrect. It was sobering, if you will. At the time, I realized as a professor by this time at East Tennessee State University, living in the Johnson City area, a hotbed of Appalachian music, then and now, I realized that I had my work cut out for me. You know, there was a whole lot of interpreting that needed to be done to bring the true picture of Appalachian cultural history to the public's attention. And so out of this activity, I think, led to a new commitment on my part to work harder, to play my role as Appalachian Studies instructor at East Tennessee State, and as an aficionado and a lover of Appalachian music. I realized that the music was the great vehicle for change, but I had to, you know, get active and find ways to bring clearer images of Appalachia and more balanced images to others. And I'm not saying I did this alone by any stretch. I'd like to share with you just some things that we confronted at the time. Obviously, the extensive popularity of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the film, and the soundtrack, and the soundtrack obviously more so than the film, had a huge impact on affixing or proliferating certain images of Appalachia. You know, it's so ironic, as much of the film took place outside of Appalachia in the Delta and whatnot, and yet the media over and over again labeled the music of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou as Appalachian. It was troubling. I mean, Brian Mansfield, I mean, not to pick on one critic, but I thought it was pretty glaring that the USA Today's chief music critic labeled the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou as Appalachian music. And, you know, he did so with all affection, but it was nonetheless trucking in all these positive stereotypes, which are just as damaging as the negative ones. And of course, there are negative stereotypes embedded in this film that the Coen brothers, of course, tried to critique and to some degree kind of lampoon. It was kind of a pastiche of different images that the film was based on. And then, of course, the whole aftermath of the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou phenomenon down from the mountain, when, you know, T-Bone Burnett was very active, you know, bringing these fascinating modern collections out that were interpreting Appalachian music. And then, of course, this really affectionate set that came out about the same time based on the Cold Mountain novel, which was also late 90s and had its peak of popularity about the same time as Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. This was the backdrop to the work that I set myself out to do, another soundtrack that T-Bone Burnett worked on that was, again, popular but problematical because of the images of Appalachia that it projected and the narrative it provided as far as what Appalachian music was and what it wasn't. One of my colleagues at East Tennessee State University, Roy Andrade, in fact, played on the Cold Mountain soundtrack, and I got a great deal of inside kind of information about this project. And it was both remarkable what T-Bone Burnett was able to do and at times a bit troubling. And then, of course, offshoots. Rounder put this out. There are so many other things we could say about the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou phenomenon, but I'll just leave it at that, is that it became a distraction, really, I believe, to a true kind of dissemination of information about Appalachian music that would have been helpful to my students at East Tennessee State University, as well as people across the United States and around the world. At the same time, organizations whose work we would be inclined to respect, National Geographic being one, and then the Rough Guide series, put out Appalachian music anthologies, where if you really analyze the contents, you realize that even these heralded organizations, or, you know, much ballyhooed, trustworthy organizations, had a pretty fuzzy view of what was Appalachia and what wasn't. And so this was, you know, these were all happening at the same time as the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou phenomenon. You know, even in the classical world or popular classical world, you know, they were using the term Appalachian very sentimentally as a way to promote, you know, the concept of heartland and mainstream American culture. I guess at one level you could say harmless, but on the other hand, there was no real effort in the interpretive notes to explain the terms that were being used. And I would argue.
Nobody's on that record, are they?
Exactly. Exactly. Well. Yeah, well, now a couple of the artists, of course, Edgar Meyer from the Appalachian region, so we can say things like that. I mean, it was very affectionate. It certainly was Bela Fleck, was a student of Jack Tottle, a gentleman I mentioned earlier, who started ETSU's Bluegrass program. These are people who had it in their hearts and in their minds, were committed to kind of celebrating Appalachian music. It's just that the knowledge base was limited and not really important for the dissemination of the music. And here, a Rhino release in 95, this is going back a few years, conjoined the term bluegrass and Appalachian very overtly, whereas if you look on the lineup of a set like this, at least half the artists were from outside the region of Appalachia. Not to, you know, nitpick, but just to say that Appalachian bluegrass are a troubling kind of conflation. We all know, of course, Bill Monroe's growing up in western Kentucky outside of Appalachia. It's a complex thing, and I don't want to belabor the point, but just to say that we continue to struggle with this conflation today, even in the heart of Appalachia, East Tennessee State University, where our much kind of appreciated program, the one that we dedicated so much of our work to at East Tennessee State, the Bluegrass program, started by my friend and colleague Jack Tottle, has had to expand its moniker to acknowledge the fact that by only calling themselves the Bluegrass program, they were in fact ignoring 90% of their own music history. So they've expanded the title to be the Bluegrass Old Time and Country Music Program. But there's even talk about maybe changing that and coming up with some other kind of more all-inclusive title, perhaps something like Appalachian Music Program. That's not official, but it's an ongoing dialogue and an interest in representing through our official label exactly what our mission is, which is to go beyond any one genre to a holistic view of regional music. Now I want to honor the great records that have been made of Appalachian music that have been done, some of them extremely influential, some of them really solid and well-annotated anthologies. Obviously, you know, the Library of Congress field recordings, Classic Mountain Songs, Kentucky Mountain Music, a tremendous set, Music of Coal. These are ones to be applauded. They were doing things right, and they were the backdrop to my own inspiration. And in the interest of time, I'll just move forward, but I do want to acknowledge what's been done well in the area of Appalachian music. This was a project that I worked on. This was probably the first record project I worked on, although I didn't have any official role in selecting the tracks, and I'm not necessarily defending the lineup that was selected for this CD companion to the film, but I worked on the film and was interviewed for it about Appalachian music. I was not really brought aboard onto the CD soundtrack for this film, PBS film, but I was brought on board for this one, Appalachian Music from Home. These were, in fact, competing PBS projects. And this second one was much larger and more extensive. And I worked with a gentleman named Ron Short on this CD and wrote the liner notes for it, or the liner essay. And so it was kind of the beginning of my own personal trajectory of trying to produce a new generation of Appalachian music anthologies. I didn't, in fact, select the material for this, I'll point out, but I did confer and worked kind of behind the scenes in that whole process and wrote the liner notes. So I do want to say that this was, I think, a good step in the right direction, at least from my own vantage point, in terms of large media attention, but focusing in on artists, for the most part, who had a relationship with Appalachia. Now, this is something I take full blame and for. I worked from the beginning to the end on this one, and the first project that I was kind of responsible for solely, working with some good friends, but in terms of a production aspect and an interpretive aspect. I did work with one aspect of the project with Michael Montgomery. He wrote a biography of the field collector of these recordings, whose name was Joseph Hall, who worked in the Smokies in the 1930s. Beyond that, though, I was basically asked by the Great Smoky Mountains National Park to delve into the archives and to find a sufficient number to release on a non-for-profit single CD anthology of Smoky Mountain music. This is a fascinating story. We could talk about it for a long time, but let's just put it this way. These were voices of the people who gave their homes and farms to create the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And they're, if not for Joseph Hall, this wonderful man who wandered through the Smokies working for the federal government as a field recordings, a collector of speech and music in the 1930s, if not for Joseph Hall, these voices would never have been heard by a new generation. These recordings were sitting in archives and really unheard except for by the most, shall we say, committed of scholars, and there weren't probably too many people who had heard them over the years. We brought them out in 2008 and then a new edition in 2012. And they caught a lot of attention because I think most Americans weren't aware that the park was created from the donations, sometimes unwittingly, you know, against their will perhaps, but donations of lands by people who gave up everything to create the park that is America's most popular national park. And then led to this. Charles Wolfe passed away in 2006. And one of the kind of unstated commitments I made to Charles, one of the last times I spoke with him at the book signing event for the book that I mentioned earlier, was that someday we'll get all those records out so that students can know the full story of the Bristol Sessions. Now, this is something, to be fair, that Charles tried to do at several points in his career. In fact, he did do in the form of a cherry-picked two-album anthology of Bristol Sessions tracks that came out in the mid-80s by the Country Music Foundation, and a very wonderful set. The problem was, of course, is that set did only select certain tracks and left out others, and also did not include any of the 1928 Bristol Sessions, which were a wonderful field recording session as well. And so, in essence, the way things work in the modern world, I sent an email to Bear Family Records and Richard Weitzer, many of you know him, and he was, of course, here at the conference a couple days ago. He wrote me right back and said, let's do it. You know, that kind of gung-ho attitude was amazing to me, and we just, working with Tony Russell and Chris King, we put this out in a matter of maybe 10 months. It was very quickly done, and I can say made an impact because now there's going to be a $14 million museum in downtown Bristol dedicated to the story of the Bristol Sessions, for your information. And this was a major fundraising vehicle for that museum. They used the box set as a promotional gift and raised that money, much of that money, from private donors. Of course, they also got state and federal money, but just for your information, it did have that impact. There was much more to the story that Charles himself and Tony Russell were well aware of, but nobody had really taken the time or trouble to research it until after the Bristol Sessions box set came out with Bear Family Records and did well in a variety of standpoints. Bear Family said, do a follow-up, Johnson City Sessions. It took us about 12 months of research, Tony Russell and I, and we came out last fall with the Johnson City Sessions with Bear Family. Now, what Dick said earlier about the recordings of Johnson City being just as strong as the Bristol Sessions recordings, I wholeheartedly concur. This is, in fact, probably my favorite of the two sets, musically speaking. It's an amazing document that Frank Walker, with the Columbia label, was able to achieve in 28 and 29. When we did the research, none of the artists were still living, but their family members had all the memorabilia and were almost just waiting for somebody to express an interest in them. So they were most generous, and much of our research came from interpersonal dialogue with family members. We also were able to discover for the very first time the location of the important 1929 Johnson City Sessions. It ended up being in a utility building that had been disguised within a church, therefore had been kind of overlooked for years and years. So we made new discoveries in the process, of course, as well as bringing this previously undocumented story forward. In the interest of time, I'll just share with you a couple recent projects that I've been working on. Do any of you know Carol Best? He's a tremendous player of old-time tunes on the three-finger banjo style. He was a pioneer of the melodic banjo style. These are more recordings from the Joseph Hall collection. It's a sequel to the old-time Smoky Mountain music record. It's coming out next month. These are from 1956 and 1959, and it's arguable to say that they document the very first recorded applications of the melodic banjo style. So before Bobby Thompson was recorded, and apparently Carol Best and Bobby Thompson were good friends, so there was some sharing there, possibly back and forth, although Bobby Thompson was quite clear to acknowledge Carol Best's influence. Bill Keith, after whom the style was later named, was a little bit later than this. So this is a new project. Next month in June, yes. Uh-huh. The White Oak String Band, they were all from Haywood County, North Carolina. The set that I mentioned earlier that was so influential upon me, 17,000 copies, were released by Elektra in conjunction with Folkways back in 64. It was an important release, of course. Culturally speaking, had an impact on a lot of people. I was far from the only one to whom this was a major impact. But now, in 2014, I'm very happy to say it's been reissued. I was actually a part of that process. Worked with Jack Holzman of Elektra in bringing this out. This was a Rhino Records Record Store Day release of last month. So I'm happy also to report that it was awarded the Golden Gear Award for Best Record Day Store Release. But be that as it may, bringing it full circle, all our lives, everyone in this room has a personal story about their journey to music. And I've been sharing you a bit about mine, and it's ongoing. There are future projects and this sort of thing. But bringing it all back, this was something I was happy to be a part of for a number of reasons, not least of which is because I know there are people out there whose lives will be changed forever by exposure to this anthology, which, alas, has now been reissued on LP, vinyl, not on CD. So access will be limited, I suppose, but on the other hand, if the inquiring mind wants to hear and to know, they will find a way to listen to it. I've gone over, I suppose, so I don't know if it's appropriate to take questions or just to say thank you very much and have a good break, but I'll talk with you folks at length afterwards. Thank you. I did come up with some compilation guidelines for the future work that I'll share with you here.